Well, we are winding down on our series on marriage and family, and I just thought it necessary and hopefully wise to say something about getting started after all. And in a sense, this series kind of loops itself around because we're talking about getting started, and then if we were to start the series over, what would we talk about but a godly family? God give us Christian homes and so on, and laying the foundation. But choosing a husband or a wife with biblical values and a life of service to Christ in mind, I mean, this is important. This is extremely important. And it's not something that comes naturally. It's not something that you get automatically. Many Christians probably never receive direct teaching or training on choosing a mate. Not all parents provide that kind of guidance or lay down those kinds of expectations. Certainly no parent wants to see their child divorce. And yet, if you do not prepare them for marriage, including what kind of person to marriage, then you have not helped to prevent this either. So it's a very important responsibility on the parents' part. On the other hand, sometimes young people don't want to listen. They don't want to listen to their parents. They don't want to listen to the church. They don't want to listen to God's word. They don't want to hear those who've been there and done that because, you know, their situation's always different, right? They don't want to listen to good advice. Sometimes young people put more stock in immediate gratification than they do long-term investments. Sadly, I think just about every one of those young people later on regret doing that. But it's difficult sometimes to communicate that up front. For the sake of this lesson, I'm not going to pick on the parents. I'm not going to pick on young people. We're going to assume that everyone, parents and young people, are on board with this. That parents give their full support, and that we have the young people's full and interested attention. In light of that, if that were true, what would be the very best advice that we parents could give to our children with regard to choosing a mate? The first thing that I would say is there is no perfect list because God did not write a list. If he had written one, then we would have a perfect list. There is no perfect list, and yet there are enough principles and implications and lessons in his word to provide a fairly good assessment of what to do and what not to do. The second thing I would say up front is there's no such thing as a perfect spouse. No young person here will find one, and no young person here will be one. And it's not suggested that you look for perfection because you will be disappointed. But we do strongly urge our young people not to settle for, first of all, the first candidate that shows interest in you, or someone that merely will do, or anyone that raises red flags, and I'll talk about red flags here shortly. I would strongly urge all young people, or even if you're not young but you're considering marriage, to take your time. Do not rush into a premature decision. I strongly suggest this, do not get married before you're 20 years old. This is not a doctrine. This is Chad's strong opinion. Take it for what it is. The reason I say that is because most boys are not yet mature enough to be married before that age. And I'm a boy and I can say that, okay? And that the second reason is most young people, boys and girls, do not really know what they want before that age. There's no guarantee they know after that age either, but especially before that age. They're just not usually prepared for that. Keep your standards high, but do not be unrealistic in your standards. If no one, including yourself, can live up to your standards, then you're never going to find anyone. And at the same time, it is better not to marry at all. This is a serious point. Please listen. It is better not to marry at all than to marry someone whom you never should have married in the first place because you had very low standards or because you had no standards at all. You got to have standards. You got to have something by which to gauge a proper mate, if you will. Or if you don't like the word mate, use a different word. Spouse-to-be, fiancé, okay, and so on. The first set of criteria we're going to cover here are what might be called serious red flag issues. If your marriage candidate, there's another way you could express it, does not match these things, then you should seriously question whether or not you should continue in a forward direction with this person at all. Now, you're going to look at some of these things and you're going to say, oh, I don't agree with all those. Okay, you don't have to. Remember, God did not write the list. We're assembling this list from principles and values and so on that we glean from Scripture. But take it to heart what is being said. First of all, first on the list, marry a Christian. If indeed you are a Christian, then marry someone of like faith. By Christian, we do not mean a churchgoer who happens to be part of a congregation because they're in the directory. We're talking here about someone who is genuinely a Christian per the biblical requirements. They do not think they're a Christian. They do not feel that they're a Christian. They are indeed a Christian by what the Bible teaches. And they walk in a manner worthy of the Lord and of His gospel. Marry someone like that. Christians and non-Christians do not share the same beliefs. They do not share the same values. They do not share the same spiritual goals. And this will lead to certain trouble for you, if indeed you marry someone like that. And then when the children come along, it simply magnifies the issue and forces the issue. Up until then, two people might say, well, you go to your church and I'll go to mine, or you don't go to church at all and I'll continue to go to mine, and we can live together in peace and harmony and coexist. But then the kids come along and it immediately forces the issue, which direction are the kids going to go? And who's going to teach them? And what are we going to teach them? And what values are we going to instill in them? When the kids come along, it will necessarily show you how difficult it is to keep that situation peaceful and coexisting. Because the fact is, it's really not a peaceful coexistence. It automatically, ultimately, divides the family, at least to some extent. Now, my words here are for those who have not yet married. If you have already done this, I am not condemning you. I want you to understand that. I'm not standing here and saying you are in condemnation because of what you did. What I'm simply saying is, what would be the best route if we could start with a clean slate? And that's where we're coming from. Okay? 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 and 15 says, "Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial," which is another word for Satan? "Or what is a believer in common with an unbeliever?" The context here is not literally talking about marriage, and yet the principles most certainly imply, what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Now, this is such an important point here. I'm going to talk about that in the lesson tonight. So I'm just going to leave the point here and say, in the most important realm of all, what does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? Some will justify, of course, but I love him or I love her, and that's going to make it all right, right? Works on TV, works in the movies. The fact is, love by itself does not make all problems go away, does not make all red flags disappear. God loves all people too, but most people do not love him in return, and because of that causes him all kinds of grief. So don't think that just because you love each other that that's going to smooth everything out. It's all going to be good, even though you have different faiths and different beliefs and different spiritual values, that love will conquer all, okay? It's really not going to be that way if indeed you do not have the same Lord. Others will say, well, but I have a positive influence on this person. I am convinced that when we get married, that I will change him. And I say it that way with the him part, okay, because women often go into marriage thinking that they're going to change their husbands. Men often go into the marriage hoping their wives will stay the same forever. Right, Jeff? Jeff said that almost verbatim in his class on marriage here in one of our talks here last month. So I want you to think about this, this idea here that you think you're going to change, and you might even cite 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, where it says, you know, if your husband is an unbeliever, and by your good conduct and character, you might win over your husband. That may be true, but Peter is not saying marry an unbeliever there in order to do that. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, if you happen to find yourself in that situation, then this is what you ought to do. My 30-plus years of experience as a Christian, I have seen very few turnarounds. They have happened, but they've been very rare. But I have seen many, many situations where the husband or the wife regretted the decision of marrying an unbeliever, gave up the fight, fell away, or compromised their faith in some way. I have seen that many more times than not, for what it's worth. Secondly, marry one who loves the Lord more than they love you. I think this is some of the best information we could instill within our young people. Marry someone who loves the Lord more than they love you. Because if they love the Lord more than they love you, then they're always going to act in your best interest. And they're always going to serve you with a Christ-like spirit. And they're always going to put godly motives and godly teaching in the home. And they're always going to try to serve Christ in every way, which means you benefit from that. And that's exactly what's being talked about there in Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 through 5. Here's someone who does not think of their own interest, but they think of yours. They do not think of their own selfishness, okay, but they actually look to what can I do for you with a servant heart. And they have the attitude in themselves, which is also in Christ. Wouldn't you like to marry someone like that? That's an ideal candidate right there. So apply that to your candidate for marriage. Isn't that what you want? Don't say, well, no, I want someone who loves me more than anything. Well, that works for movies and that works for love songs, but it doesn't work in real life. In real life, if you want it done the right way, you want someone who worships God with all their being. And that person will likely turn out to be a great spouse for you. Marry someone who demonstrates faithfulness or fidelity to the relationship. Marriage is a covenant relationship and has to be honored and respected as such. And that person must not only honor his spouse, but also the pact that holds the two of you together. Not just you, but also the us here, as we've talked about in previous lessons. Throughout the New Testament, it says God is faithful. And so must your spouse be faithful. And if he or she is showing signs of unfaithfulness, moral irresponsibility, or flippant disregard for the relationship now, you've got to understand it's not going to improve once you get together. In fact, the motive for being faithful then will be perhaps even less. Because he got away with it before, and you still married him. And now, what is there? One who has little respect for God obviously will have very little respect, or could have very little respect anyway, for the marriage covenant. So keep your eyes open and observe this person that you're considering. Marry someone who is honest. Marry someone who is honest with you while you're dating. Because if they're honest with you while you're dating, hopefully they will be honest with you when they're married. But if they're dishonest with you when you're dating, then you better be sure that they're probably going to be dishonest with you when you're married. Imagine what heartache you're going to be facing later on. Honesty does not mean just telling the truth when you're asked. It also means being truthful at all times in all circumstances, whether you're asked direct questions or not. An honest person is not afraid to be accountable. The honest person is not afraid or gets offended when someone questions his behavior. Marry someone who is forgiving. You are not a perfect person. I know, I'm in the hot seat now because I just told you that. But the fact is, none of us, yourself included, myself included, are perfect people. And if you marry someone who is legalistic and judgmental and unreasonably critical, then you do not have a chance of faring well in the future, because pretty soon they're going to turn that critical eye away from other people and other things, and they're going to focus it right on you. And so, legalism leads to separation, not unity. Legalism is a poisoning of the mind. And when your spouse is hypercritical of everything you or your family or your friends do, then that becomes an endless source of grief for you. Some of you, no hands please, can probably speak from experience on this. What is in your best interest instead is to find someone who can deal with your faults in a Christ-like manner. As we've talked about over here in Colossians chapter 3, we've cited this passage probably a couple times during this series because it's just an excellent passage for this particular subject. Those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another, forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. That is the kind of person you should be looking for to marry. That's what you want to find. That's the short list of critical issues. If your spouse-to-be does not make that list, Here's Chad's opinion for what it's worth. Run away as fast as you can and find someone else. Your soul is far too important to be compromised by someone else's self-serving behavior or by their failure to be morally responsible to God. You are putting your soul in jeopardy for someone else's sake, and I'm telling you, it's really not worth it. There are other qualities or characteristics worth looking for. Some of these might be more important than others. You might have organized this differently had you written the lesson, but for the sake of simply covering these in at least brief detail, marry a virgin. Chastity and virginity are subjects that are almost laughed at anymore because everybody's supposed to experience, you know, sex and intimacy or whatever they call it anymore in the profane sense there. Everyone's supposed to experience that before marriage. Living together has become almost regular, if not accepted in all circles. So this point here seems to fall upon deaf ears sometimes. But here's someone who has already given himself or herself to someone else, if indeed they're not a virgin. And what they should have saved as a gift for you and you alone, they gave to someone else, and you'll never get that back. In Leviticus 21, verse 7 through 15, I'll let you read that on your own. The Old Testament priests were only allowed to marry virgins because with God it was a purity issue. God wanted his people to be solely dedicated to him. And so the concept there is marry someone who is solely dedicated to you in every way. And this is not a deal breaker, I understand. And honestly, sadly, it might be hard to find a virgin to marry in our day and age. But it often reveals something unflattering about the person who you're considering if he or she has already given themselves away to someone else, so to speak. Marry someone who is not lazy, whether it is a man or a woman. Laziness is a moral weakness. Laziness often leads to dishonesty, freeloading, poverty, petty crimes, and other irresponsibility. You marry someone who's lazy, you get what you paid for, so to speak, right? I mean, you really are inviting all kinds of grief and heartache for yourself. Marry someone who wants children and who wants to raise children and, yes, even discipline children in the same way that you do. Do not assume that this is going to take care of itself later on. This is important information, important criterion that needs to be determined up front before the kids ever come along or should come along even. Marry someone who is loving and considerate, not only with you, but also with all people. Love is a godly virtue, and one who loves like God loves with the best kind of love and likely will have other virtues as well. Seek after someone then who is striving after that, who especially is striving after all of the fruit of the Spirit. Go down Galatians chapter 5, verse 22 and 23, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, self-control, etc., and go through that list and say, wouldn't I like to marry a person who is pursuing all of those virtues? And yes, you would. I'll just answer that for you. You would like to marry someone like that. You will be happy with that person. Marry someone with common interests and common backgrounds. That doesn't mean you have to have everything in common. Don't think that. Like, oh, we have one thing that's not in common. It's a deal breaker. No, it's not. But you need to have at least a good overlapping here. And the reason I'm saying that is so that you will spend time together in doing things that you have in common rather than pursuing your own very different interests with other people outside of your us relationship. And what happens naturally there is you tend to separate from each other rather than coming together. So it's not like you have to like everything your spouse likes, but there should be a lot of overlap, okay? There's things that I do, I am certain, that honey is not so particularly fond of. And that goes both ways. She can go into Joanne Fabrics and has no problem with it. I break out in hives, okay? So there's some certain things that we have to separate. She listens to country music. I certainly do not. But we have a lot in common, and we're able to spend a lot of time together because of that, and that's what makes it all work. Marry someone who can accept constructive criticism and correction. A person who is hypersensitive and gets emotionally defensive and even hostile every time you point out something that needs to be corrected, or any time that someone offers even constructive criticism, that person is shouting to you, in essence, that I am insecure or I am spiritually immature. Listen to that shouting before you marry them, rather than just say, well, I'll change them afterwards. No, you won't. Probably not. In fact, it'll change you afterwards. Marry someone who is financially responsible, who knows the meaning of hard-earned money, who exhibits good management, good stewardship, good restraint towards spending. If your boyfriend, for example, is irresponsible with his own money now, you can be sure he's likely to be irresponsible with your collective money later. In fact, understand that money issues is one of the leading causes of divorce. So you can't take this point very lightly. It's a serious point. Marry someone who is optimistic, someone who is joyful, has a good self-image, strives to do what is right. Rejoice always in the Lord. And I say again, rejoice. Find someone who takes that passage there, Philippians 4, verse 4, very seriously and lives by that. You do not want to spend the rest of your life trying to jack up somebody else's spirits because they're always down or they're always depressed or they're always grousing about something or always complaining, always critical. You do not want to spend the rest of your life trying to overcome that person's negativity and pessimism. There are some things, of course, to avoid, some serious things, in my opinion. First of all, do not marry anyone who is guilty of physical or mental abuse. There are many wives who have been married to abusive husbands, and they have become codependent. They live in fear. They live in misery. And if your friend who you're considering for marriage is a controlling and especially physically domineering person or uses violence as a means of getting his own way, run, run, run away. And do not let your emotions cloud the issue. Do not say, but I love him, because he's going to beat the tar out of you possibly someday, and your love is not going to stop that. And so you've got to understand here what's at stake here, that you are consigning yourself to a life of misery and heartache possibly because you made a decision that was based on emotions rather than on common sense. I'm trying to spare you here, anyone who's listening. Do not marry someone with a bad temper. Do not marry someone who is consistently, chronically hostile and bitter, or who has anger issues, and it actually admits it. Yeah, I've got some anger issues, you know. Do not marry someone who explodes in anger when frustrated and things don't go his or her way. If that person does it now, they're going to only make it worse for you once you're together, and you will be the object of that anger and hostility eventually. If not now, it will be soon. Do not marry someone who is addicted, especially to tobacco, alcohol, or drugs. Someone says, oh, come on, now, tobacco? Listen, here's the deal. If someone is living their life under the influence or control of something else, they cannot give themselves entirely to you, and especially cannot give themselves entirely to God. If they're already enslaved to their addiction, then what are you going to do? And if they're unwilling to get help and give that addiction up during the courtship, then what they're proclaiming to you is, that addiction of mine is more important than you are. And you're going to marry them anyway? That just doesn't even make sense. And once again, don't think love is going to conquer all there. Okay? Not if that person is under the spell of some other controlling influence there. In summary, young women ought to be searching for a young man who, first of all, will lead her and his family in the Lord, not someone that she has to drag to church or drag to a Bible study or make feel guilty so that he'll say a prayer for the family or something like that. This is a serious character flaw with many young men today. Do not let it be a point of compromise for you. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 4 and 5, what we're finding here is that Christian leadership does not begin in a church building. It does not begin in a church service. It actually begins in the home. And this is talking about an elder candidate, which obviously is more likely a more mature man than a young man might be. But nonetheless, we're looking at ideals here. And it says of that elder candidate, he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. If he doesn't know how to manage his own household, how is he going to take care of the church of God? You want someone who is at least heading in that direction, who is putting that kind of value on in his life and saying, this is the kind of person I strive to be, and actually exhibits that, doesn't just talk to impress you or to perhaps convince you, but rather is exhibiting that. He needs to be a good provider, someone who's willing to hold a job and support his family, even if it means doing something he doesn't like as he's working towards something that he does like. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, if anyone doesn't provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. You've got to take that very seriously. You've got to understand that you need to find someone who is a provider. Okay? Not just someone who talks about providing. Not someone who says, well, I left my last 13 jobs because I just wasn't happy, or, you know, they were doing things to me I didn't like. If you're seeing chronic habits like that or chronic behavior like that, run away. Okay? Once again, do not let your emotions cloud the issue. You want someone who is a good protector, young ladies. Not just talking physical protection here or physical security. We're also talking about moral, emotional, even spiritual protection in essence. What you want basically is someone who is willing to lay down his life literally and figuratively for you. That's the kind of man you're looking for. And what do young men search for? Well, they should be searching for a young woman who, first of all, is a person of high moral character. She has a good self-image. And honestly, and if I can speak from personal observation over a number of years of observation, women struggle with this. So it's not easy to find a woman who has a very good self-image. And dresses with modesty, again, a difficult thing to find anymore in young women. Speaks with virtue and grace rather than employing the gutter language of her culture. And seeks the best interests of those around her, whether it's you or anyone else. That's the kind of woman that you're looking for. That she will be a good mother, someone who loves children and looks forward to raising a family in the Lord. And she is feminine and carries herself with grace and womanly discretion. Rather, many girls today are looking more and more manly and bland in their dress and their behavior and their demeanor. It's almost like everyone's just blending into one gender, in a sense. Men are becoming more effeminate, women are becoming more masculine, and, you know, we're just kind of all blah together. It's just seeming to become like that. And what you want is someone who is not afraid to stand up and be a woman in her femininity, in her grace, in her virtue, in her character. I strongly recommend, you say this is some of your opinion, okay, I'll give you that. I strongly recommend avoid someone who is covered with tattoos, someone who is unwilling to wear a dress and look pretty, someone who feels content to wear a t-shirt and sweats everywhere she goes with you, including services. And unfortunately, there's a lot of those women out there. And my advice to you is run away. And again, do not let your emotions cloud your judgment. Choosing a marriage partner is one of the most important decisions of your life. The most important decision outside of your own commitment to God. Take your time in making this decision. Put much effort into making this decision. The best scenario is write down your expectations before you start dating. That way you don't start writing down the characteristics and the behavior of the one who you've already become enamored with, and then he looks great, or she looks great. Well, yeah, because you basically wrote her down. Write down these expectations before you start looking, so that you can be objective in your assessment and keep your eye out for these people. Now, I'm going to be frank here. It is hard to find someone who's going to fit all of those things. We are being a bit idealistic in our expectations, and I understand that. But you've got to have some high expectations here to start with. You can't start low. You've got to have high expectations. And one thing also ought to be obvious here is that if you have high expectations for your mate, that must mean that you also have high expectations for yourself. Because you can't expect your mate to conform to all your expectations when you yourself are unwilling to do so. When you basically hold up a list and say, well, let me see how you hold up to my expectations. But when the same list is held up to you, you fail miserably. That's not good. So you have to ask yourself, as you're searching for a mate, what do you yourself have to offer? What do you have to offer someone else? I have heard so many times women and men say basically, well, if anyone loves me, they're going to have to love me just the way I am. And sadly, they have not very much to offer. And sadly, sometimes those people lead long, lonely lives because they refused to have any real expectations of their own for themselves, for their own conduct, for their own behavior. So not only should someone have something to offer you, you should have something to offer them. So take a good, long, hard look in the mirror and examine your own qualities and your own character and your own disposition there. Again, no one's going to be a perfect spouse. That's a given. But this is not the point. At the same time, you can't settle for average or even below average just because you didn't want to take the time and effort to find someone who is worth your time and effort. Don't just choose someone based on looks alone, like so many people do. It is better to find someone of Christ-like virtue than to find someone that everyone else thinks is adorable. Find someone who's like Christ. You'll do well with that person. And above all, pray often and earnestly that God will allow your path to intersect with the very person that could serve as an ideal spouse for you. It doesn't mean there's just one out there. There could be 100,000 potential candidates. But let God direct you to finding at least one of those that will work. We'll talk more about associations and our choices tonight. That's our lesson for this morning. If there's anyone subject to our invitation, we often offer an invitation for the sake of those who have been thinking about becoming Christians or who need spiritual help in some way in the form of our prayers and encouragement. If we can help you with that, if you need to come forward, do so as we stand and sing the song that's been selected.